So some of you were here a couple weeks ago when I offered some reflections on this theme of caring for one another. I had read the Kuchivikara Sutta, the Monk with Dysentery Sutta, and it very much inspired me to look more closely at the Buddha's teachings on essentially caring for one another. And one of the things that I'm enjoying about reading the suttas directly for myself is that it allows for making connections that I didn't used to get just by picking up another teacher's Dharma reflections. I think that way kept me a little more linear. And now it seems that when there's a willingness to dive into the suttas for oneself, it's as though you can pick a thread and then follow it and really get to know it for yourself and have a spirit of inquiry. And I notice that sometimes what comes up for me is, well, now why is the Buddha highlighting that? Why is he guiding at that sort of action? And so it can be a very rich process of exploration and a way of taking the teachings to heart for oneself. You don't just read it and say, okay, that's how it is. You invite a sense of grappling with it or a sense of curiosity. And in this theme of caring, it's probably no surprise. I mean, the notion of caring is threaded throughout the Buddha's teachings, right? There's the practice of the Brahma Viharas, so we cultivate goodwill, that sense of love or kindness, well-wishing for all beings, right? We overcome any sense of bias or preference and open our hearts to all of life, wishing for well-being, and then when it's turned towards suffering. Okay, thanks. When that tender heart is turned towards suffering, it quivers and it responds. And so we know this from these teachings, as well as the precepts, which vary almost from the beginning of coming to practice. We are encouraged to practice with the precepts of non-harming, and that they really provide a great sense of safety and protection. It's really one of the highest gifts, it probably is the highest gift we can offer to ourselves and to others, is that feeling of you're safe, right? And I think that's one of the great gifts of Sangha. When we come here, maybe we don't bring in that sense of safety, but over time we come to understand that we're around people who aren't going to harm us. And in the best case, that actually they're going to see and lift up the best in us, which is a great act of care, right? To really help us more fully become that which within us is able to live with greater ease and greater freedom. And so this spirit, I guess today's talk is really sharing with you my exploration, and I invite you not to take it on faith. These are my words. We'll draw on the Buddha's words. But there's really an invitation to listen to it, to see what resonates, what rubs, and to explore both of those for yourself throughout the rest of the time today on the retreat, but in your life, just to see if there's something in here that feels onward leading to more skillful states and more ease and well-being. So there are three suttas that bubbled up for my and really grabbed my attention. And part of what really struck me is this movement from cultivating mind states to action in the world. And I think we all know for ourselves, if we really think about this path, we see it take root and take shape and influence in how we treat others, right? So we can notice maybe that we have different mind states, but really the proof of the practice is in our actions. So body, speech, and mind. The Buddha wasn't encouraging blind faith or just belief. This isn't a practice of just learning the tenets and having a strong ideology. It's about becoming free. And so people can be a great, or other beings, so not just people, but suffering in the world is a great measure of our mind. How are we responding when we see others who are in need, when we see injustice or harm? How do we respond? That's a beautiful place of practice, right? Because this path of freedom is about knowing our minds. And the more we come to see the habits and we dial in and see that we have a choice to respond in ways that lead to freedom, we naturally become more caring and responsive. I would guess that most of us, if we look at the arc of our lives since we came to the Dharma, one of the things that's changed is we more easily respond wanting to help others. And so I think this path of care is sort of a movement from self-centeredness into a natural, how can I help? But it's something that we journey. There's no prescription. It doesn't happen step one, step two, step three. It doesn't look the same for me as for Betsy or Shiva or any one of us. It's an individualized, this is an individualized path, and we all are dealing with different causes and conditions, different patternings, different supports and obstacles. And so the way this manifests will look differently for each of us. So let's look a little more closely at the teachings directly. And I hope it will be obvious what are the Buddha's words and what are my interpretations. So just to know that. And if there's something that I say that's helpful, I appreciate that. But I think the invitation is really to hear the Buddha's teachings and find your own engagement with them. So in the Monk with Dysentery Sutta, it's really quite moving to me. To me it shows, I'll first just describe it. So the Buddha was walking with Ananda and inspecting the monks' dwellings, and then they were just going from one to the next, and they came across a monk who was lying on the floor in his dwelling in urine and feces and very weak. And the Buddha said, "Hey, what's going on here?" And the monk just said, "Well, I'm sick and I'm of no use to these other monks, so they're not helping." And so the Buddha and Ananda reached down, they picked up the monk, put him on his bed, cleaned him up, cleaned up the dwelling. And then the Buddha said, "Ananda, call the other monks together. We are going to need to talk about this." And so he brought them together and he said, "Do you know that there's a monk who's sick?" And they said, "Oh yeah, we know that." And he said, "Well, why aren't you attending to them?" And they said, "Well, he's of no use to us." Right? And the Buddha very calmly just said, "You don't have a mother or father. If you don't care for one another, who will?" So I'm paraphrasing here. "You should care for each other as you would care for me." It's quite lovely. Right? And I think, for me, it's a beautiful, beautifully human story, not just of the Buddha, but of the awakening mind, right? That It's tender. It's not cold. I mean, we often talk about equanimity and dispassion, and I think some people think that we just become unfeeling. But the truth is we become quite tender, and we know how to respond appropriately. You know, so the Buddha saw this monk in distress. He tended to him. And then with compassion, he also called together the monks to offer them a teaching. Because this attitude of, he's of no use to me or to us, is really an action of aversion, right? It's a misplaced, confusion, right? That I don't need him. And is that, well, I don't need him in this moment, right? If you're living in community, you're interrelated. And so the Buddha was really trying to help them to see, don't go there, don't go down that path. If you're serious about liberation, every experience is an encounter with the mind's habitual responses. And this path of freedom is one of uprooting greed, ill will, and confusion. And we see through the practice of metta, so we're also cultivating generosity, goodwill, and wisdom. And the path of goodwill doesn't put anyone out of our hearts. And so if we see someone who's suffering and we are able to help, we don't just shrug, maybe toss our head back and walk away. If we do, we're strengthening the seeds of ill will within ourselves, which doesn't lead to freedom. It's a really beautiful and striking, I think, teaching that no matter what's happening, we're really looking at what are we strengthening within ourselves. And as we live in community, there are lots of opportunities to see how are we responding. And in our, I don't know how it is for you, but I know for myself, sometimes busyness crowds out a naturally caring response. And that sometimes, I think it's a really beautiful exploration to see when are we more like the Buddha and Ananda, just saying, oh my gosh, there's someone who has need and I respond. And when are we more like the monks and say, yeah, he's of no use to us. We're going to go out and do walking meditation, right? I'm going to go cultivate my mind over here and leave this person over there. Because the truth is we all do both, right? We're not enlightened. And so it's useful to see what are those patternings for each of us? And for each of us, it's different, right? Different people, different situations push our buttons. And so the Buddha then laid out, he went a little further. And he, just in case they weren't sufficiently motivated when he said, whoever would tend to me should tend to the sick, he spelled it out in a little more detail. And he essentially said, this is my interpretation, we're responsible for each other. And so he said, so if you have a teacher, you should tend to your teacher, but your teacher should also be taking care of you. Right? Which is a nice equalizer, right? It's not saying the care goes one way and there's an exalted position. The actions may look different, but that we're engaged in a reciprocal relationship of care and respect. And then he says, monk to monk, the same thing. And then at the end, he kind of goes through a couple different things, and then he just says, so if there's no teacher, no student, you don't have a fellow student, the Sangha should tend to one. So if the community doesn't take care of the person who's ill, the community itself incurs an offense of wrongdoing. It's pretty interesting. And for me, it's interesting to look at how does that relate here and now, right? I think sometimes you can read these teachings and say, that was another time, they lived in different conditions, we can just put it aside. But I think the invitation is really to grapple with it and maybe the discomfort of it. Because when I read the suttas, one of the things that I find inspiring and uplifting in a way is even despite the difference in culture, the difference in time, tradition, the Buddha's talking about the mind. And you really see it hasn't changed. I mean, perhaps we're busier because we have more stimulation, but these tendencies of mind are the same today as they were then. So that leads me to say, maybe there's something in here to look at and not just to dismiss it, you know, because it's not like we're all living in the same block or neighborhood and we're all there together. So what could we draw for this from this when we live dispersed, when we tend to live in more individualized lives, not so much in community? And what, if anything, does this mean for the Albuquerque Vipassana Sangha? Is there something as a Sangha that we could look at? I know this came up a little bit last night at our potluck, but is there some way? We have aspirations and values which are about working with people to realize the Noble Eightfold Path. But perhaps there's something we talked about last night, establishing a care committee. Is there some way we could routinize or make a special effort to draw forth resources for people when they have needs? It's beautiful to see how it happens informally here. You know, I know of countless examples when people have needed help when they've been dealing with a health issue, or they need help with transportation, or perhaps they're just feeling a sense of loneliness or dealing with some sort of difficult situation in their life, and they reach out and people respond. But is there some way to not leave that to chance or to one's own capacity to network, but to make it available more broadly, not subject to preferences, right? So it's not, oh, I like you, I'll show up for you. It's, I've decided to show up and to practice, and I'm going to respond no matter who it is. It's a pretty interesting question, I think. It's just a question. I don't have any response. But to look at what is the Buddha pointing to in saying that we should care for one another? Right? Because I remember that the Buddha just said, I teach one thing and one thing only, dukkha and the end of dukkha, which we often translate as suffering and the end, but it could be stress, dis-ease and the end of dis-ease. So he's essentially saying, I think, in caring for others, we also are taking care of ourselves. And we are cultivating mind states that are liberating. And so looking, you know, when we choose, if we see someone who needs something and we can help and we don't, you know, to me it's a little, I think it's a time to look more closely. I don't think it's a matter of, so then that means I'm cultivating ill will. That hasn't been my experience. It's more a matter of understanding what is arising. You know, so I can give one small example that has been happening over a couple of weeks. I sit on a nonprofit board that's pretty young and growing, and things are informal and rather chaotic. And people are really doing their best. And I got named to lead a committee, which I was very happy to do, and perhaps didn't realize what I was getting into. But there's someone on the committee who's really struggling to find their place on the board and on that committee. And I watched how my attitude, so she'll call me, she'll email me, you know, I don't know what I'm doing, I don't have a role, I don't have a place. And I watched for a couple weeks, really always my initial response was aversion. It was just like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, just suck it up and find a way to get it done. You know, like, we're all dealing with chaos, why are you bothering me? And as I've been reflecting on this, it's been an invitation to look at that attitude, right? To really try to understand it. What's going on? You know, so on the one hand, for me, there's a sense of, I don't have time. I feel too busy already. And then to get closer and really touch into the aggression that I was feeling. Not to try to justify it or rationalize it, but to really experience it. And when I did, I realized, oh, it's actually really unpleasant. Right? So I'm doing it to try to get myself off the hook, but it actually doesn't feel good. When I really notice it, and can I just turn and see, oh, here's someone who has a need, and not make her or me a victim or a villain. To just say, she has needs. I see right now, I can't fulfill them. That's a caring response, right? So the caring response isn't, I got to drop everything, I got to deal with this, I got to make it happen, I got to make it better, right? You can almost feel the anxiety and the selfing in that response. But that the care is the attitude in the mind, and that perhaps the best I can do is to say, again, I can't help with this. Let me talk to you about how someone else might be able to help you. You know, so I think the Buddha's pointing to what's liberating, but it's paying attention to every step of the process. It's not like we just get some formula and says, oh yeah, so someone's sick, they need a meal, I should provide it. It's not just doing the action, it's being aware of the mind states before, during, and after. Because we can do a caring action with a lot of aversion and aggression. Or with a lot of greed, like, I'm a good person, and others are going to know I'm a good person. You know, but you might resent it at the same time. So that's not really what the Buddha's pointing to. He's really saying any time we see harm or need, it's an opportunity for us to wake up. And I think there is this invitation to action, not to just sit on our cushion and say, oh, right, I see someone needs something, I'm not responding, oh, that's aversion. I mean, that can be useful, but he's saying, like, get in the trenches and see what it's like. You know, this practice isn't about meditating only. To awaken, we have to engage life, right? And even if we lived in a cave, there'd be a way where we'd be engaging life. There are life forms in a cave. And here we are in a busy and complex world. So how do we... the invitation is to continually pay attention. And I would say, to experience this sense of curiosity about what's happening and how it might be different, right? So just like in this example with the board member, just remembering this teaching was a way to hit the pause button and to interrupt just this pretty, you know, I'm aversive type. It's a pretty familiar stream of response. And in that reset, to notice what that feels like. Because I really noticed when I could make the shift and say, oh, she just needs some help. Like, there was more relaxation in the body, the mind relaxed. It was better. It wasn't, there wasn't this need to obsess about it. And to make her something or to make me something. And so I think this engagement around needs and harm is a way for us to see, are we living with life or against life, right? Are we willing to just show up and are we able to say, oh yeah, this is what's happening? Or are we caught again trying to go against it, saying, yeah, this is happening, but that's not what I want, and so I'm going to push and I'm going to try to make something happen. You know, are we trying to force life, or are we more in a Tai Chi or Aikido relationship with life, right? Taking what's coming and moving with it and turning towards what's wholesome. And just, like, I didn't need to bring, you kind of see more and more, I think we don't need to pick up the unwholesome that's coming, that's directed towards us. It's really nice when we can do that. And so then there are these two other suttas, and one I talked about on Thursday night. There's this one, the Discourse at Kosambi. And I just love this one because it starts with, the monks are really fighting over a precise point of Dharma. And they're getting to where they're like calling each other names, they can't stand to be in the same room together, you know, they're getting like totally acting out with aggression over a Dharma point. You know, the irony is just so lovely. You know, so the Buddha comes and he's like, what's going on? And he asked them, bhikkhus, when you take to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, do you on that occasion maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech, and mind, in public and in private, towards your companions in the holy life? I can only imagine them kind of going, like, you got us, right? We all get carried away. We all, even if, you know, we intend to act with metta or loving kindness, we get drawn off. So it's nice to have that reminder of like, hey, when you're throwing those daggers. And he just said, you know, if you continue with this, this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. And I think that's this point of liberation for us. We often don't see when we're engaged in aggression that it's our hearts and minds that are harmed and that we live with the consequences. You know, that's the beauty of really understanding, of right view, right? Of having that understanding of karma and the consequences of our actions. And that if we're engaged in unskillful states and acts, they have unskillful results. So as much as aggression, I mean, it can feel like I'm winning, right? I'm getting back, I'm being strong. But that's delusion, right? That's really misperceiving what's happening. And it just takes dropping in a little bit to see that and to really feel that. And so the Buddha went on to tell these monks that if they wanted to, I'll just quote him, there are six memorable qualities that create love and respect and conduce to helpfulness, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. And so first is just to notice, is there anyone in this room that doesn't want to live with concord and unity? That wants to be like really swimming in a sea of helpfulness, respect? Isn't that really what we all want to be surrounded in or immersed in? And so part of that is offering it, right? There's no guarantees of its return, but it improves your chances. And you don't carry the disturbance around. And so these six qualities, three are acts of loving kindness. So he really stresses this. It's in acts in body, speech, and mind. Right? So, you know, metta meditation practice can cultivate a mind that inclines towards goodwill, but then we need to act it out in our physical actions, as well as the most dangerous one for many of us, our speech. And so it's quite something, right? There's a lot to practice within there, but to really see if we do, I think it's obvious, really, when we really look at it this closely, it leads to love and respect and to helpfulness, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. So we really, the Buddha really is inviting us to an intention to be kind in all of our actions. And of course we're not going to do it, right? Because we got too much undertow. And so one of the things he said there, which I think is really quite effective, is when we incline towards kindness and then we find ourselves caught maybe in jealousy or backbiting or gossiping, the whole range, right, of unkind behaviors, to essentially confess it. And I know that can be kind of laden language for people who've maybe had unpleasant experiences with other spiritual traditions. But essentially what he's saying is when that happens or you transgress the precepts, just go tell someone. Tell someone who's on the path. And I've noticed for myself when I do that, it's like saying, oh, there's no room for shame here. There's no room for self-judgment. Because you know what? We're all doing the best we can. We're learning. We're trying to create new habits of mind. And so when we disclose those parts of ourselves that we might be like, oh, I can't believe I did that, we don't have to make it worse by then saying, okay, I'm not going to let anyone know, and I hope no one finds out, right? I mean, we all know that tension, right? Oh, I hope no one finds out. It's like, just go tell them. And if it's the person you're afraid will find out, maybe you just go tell them. I've been trying this out at work. And I've noticed it really leads to ease. And sometimes people look at me like, why are you telling me that? Because it may be something minor. But I was like, oh, because I don't want to be burdened. And so, of course, I'm lucky. I work with people who I can do this with, who I think appreciate it. But it also creates a sense of trust, right? So they also know I'm not going to be hiding things from them. And I know, oh, I can make mistakes. Which to me is a tremendous gift, right? To know we're not going to get it right all the time, right? We're not going to be perfect. And so we do our best. And isn't it nice? Don't you love it when you're with people who are like, ah, oh, that's okay, right? And they lift up the best in you, right? They really can connect with your intention. And it, you know, you kind of sit up a little straighter and say, yeah, I'm going to keep going. And so that's the power of experiencing regret and remorse, right? So it's not shame and guilt. Regret and remorse really can be transformative and you just let it go. So the other three of these memorable qualities is generosity. So sharing what we have. And the Buddha said, you know, he's talking to monks, but he said, including even the contents of your bowl. And we have other times where he says, you know, if you knew what I knew about generosity, you wouldn't let a meal go by without sharing it. Even if it means putting the rinse water out for some insect to benefit from. I think generosity creates a sense of sufficiency within us, right? When we can give, there's some quality of enoughness in that, which helps let go of grasping, of trying to get more or get something. And it puts us in relationship with others. And I, you know, to me, the more generous I am, I notice the more relaxed I am. And the easier it is to receive. I think many of us in this culture may get to where we give And we act with generosity, but we're pretty stingy in receiving. We don't actually let people give to us a lot of times or to help us. And I've been noticing with us establishing this home of our own, it's been great for establishing more interactions with people around giving and receiving. There's more help that's needed, and people are stepping up in a lot of ways. And I notice as I change my engagement, people really helping. You know, like today, people offered to come in and help set up in just little ways. And I was just like, oh. It's like there's a greater field of ease when we know others are going to help us succeed, help us feel safe or protected or get what we need. And there's a beautiful sense of relaxation when we can let go of what we have. I think we all know the uplift we've felt when someone's needed something and we've been able to give it. And it's not always stuff. I was recently at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies, and I was so enjoying this retreat. And I went out for a walk, and I saw this lady drive up. She gets out of her car. She has her Starbucks. She has like a handbag, some other bag, a couple boxes. She's like, I'm going to get it all, and I'm going to get it into that building over there. And my immediate reaction, I just said, let me help. And I thought, now that's a difference for me. In the past, I would have said, do you need some help? I'd be a little more tentative, like I'm not so sure. And it felt so good just to say, let me help. And then to help. And it was no big deal. I wasn't like, oh, now I can't go on my walk, and then I'll be late for meditation. You know, there's just that dropping of self-centeredness, which is also really, don't you find when that self-centeredness drops, it's just a feeling of relief? And it conduces to better meditation, right? The more relaxed we are, the less lost we are in conceit and self-centeredness, the easier it is to drop into concentration, right? So you can start to see what the Buddha was pointing to with care, right? He's pointing to insight into liberation, but all these pieces fit together. And so then the fifth state is virtue, which again, you know, dealing with language in our culture, sometimes, I don't know, it seems like virtue has become, I don't know, almost like a bad word or old-fashioned. And so we often just say ethical conduct. And ethics seems to have less reactivity for many people. And so these are saying, I'm going to do my best not to harm. I'm not going to take what's not freely offered. I'm not physically going to harm or cause the death of another being. I won't abuse my sexuality or transgress other people's relationships. I'm going to take care in my speech and really aim for it to be kind and true and useful and well-timed. And I'm going to refrain from intoxicants that cloud the mind and may lead to you breaking the other precepts, right? That's the real thing with intoxication. It's harder to keep the other four when you're intoxicated. And so I think, you know, the teaching on the precepts and ethical conduct, it's so clear how and why that leads to a mind that has more ease, right? That it really is letting go of the underlying roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. Because to harm another being, we can't really connect with its wish to be happy, right? We have to somehow see ourselves as other or different or better, usually better, sometimes worse. And taking what's not freely offered, right? If we're taking what's not ours, again, that's aggression, we're feeding that in ourselves. And so the other side of that is generosity, right? So you start to see this whole roadmap is about what's wholesome, what's unwholesome. Strengthening the mind states and actions that are wholesome and letting go of what's unwholesome. And so the sixth one is something that I talked about on Thursday, and it's what's usually described as right view. I think what the Buddha talked about here, he says, of these six memorable qualities, the highest, the most comprehensive, the most conclusive is the view that is noble and emancipating and leads the one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. So this is the view of Kamma and the Four Noble Truths. So really to engage every moment of experience, high bar, I know, but we incline this way, to seeing it through that understanding. And the more we're on this path, the more we do essentially get causes and conditions, actions and consequences. There's dukkha, there's a cause of dukkha, there's the release of dukkha, and there's the path, right? And that becomes the view with which we engage all of our relationships, all of our responsibilities, right? That becomes our framework. And when we have that, no matter whether or not we can embody it, we're headed in the right direction. And if we're really sincere in our effort to go in that direction, Guy Armstrong said, I think he's quoting the Buddha directly, but he just said, then we slope and incline towards liberation, right? Which is kind of this nice perspective, right? The real effort is to getting our view correct or headed in the right direction. And then if our effort is sincere, freedom will happen. Right? So it's not about over-efforting to try to grab or get or make freedom happen. It happens with the sincerity and the continuity of our effort. And so I'll just share again something that I shared on Thursday, just briefly. So one way to practice with this understanding of the ennobling view is to just almost carry around with you a note card or something that helps you ask these questions, because they will just pull you right up and point you in the right direction. Is there any obsession unabandoned in myself that might so obsess my mind that I cannot know or see things as they actually are? So for me, I've just shortened it to, is there obsession? And to know for yourself, what are the markers of that? You know, for me, it's I notice tightness in the body, but also storytelling and repeated storytelling, and perhaps trying to get others to agree with me. Let me tell you my story, right? There's no rest in it, right? There's just like, I'm going to keep going and perpetuate this. So. And then to ask, because sometimes if you just see it, that's it. It fades. You don't need to go any further. But sometimes there's this next step. When I pursue, develop, and cultivate this view, do I obtain internal serenity? Do I personally obtain stillness? So this is beautiful, I think, on both sides of when obsession's there, does that lead to serenity and stillness? As well as really paying attention to when obsession isn't there and whether or not that leads to serenity and stillness. Because this is part of how we repattern or recondition, right? When we notice the pleasantness of not being obsessed, it's a great feedback loop. And we will more naturally incline that way, right? Because our organisms will incline there. It's not as though we're patterned or programmed, right? I mean, this whole thing is we're conditioned to seek happiness and to seek what's pleasant. And this is a wholesome attunement to what's pleasant. So several weeks, or if not months ago, I talked a little bit about, or shared a little bit from the Buddha's advice to Sigalaka, and this is the Sigalavada Sutta, and it's advice to householders. So that's all of us, and I really like that part. Because a huge part of this path is good friends, where I think the Buddha actually said it's the whole of the path. So that just that is an interesting statement to explore and to see how do we receive, what are we receiving through good friendship? What does it support and bring out in us? What are we willing to offer as a good friend? What's our commitment to being a good friend? And how expansive can we get? Are we just saying, well, I'll just try this out with Sangha buddies because that's kind of a safe place, or I'll try it out with the people that I like? Or can we take it like metta and make it boundless? Right? So one place to explore is, where do we say yes, where do we say no? How do we divide the world into in-groups and out-groups? Those worthy of our attention and our love, and those unworthy of our attention and love. And to explore this, not as a guilt trip or anything, but to see that as part of the path of awakening and liberation. For me, more and more, I'm curious about extending it beyond humans. Like, I have so much training to kind of just be in reaction and in relationship and primarily thinking about humans, but to take it beyond that to all beings everywhere, including the earth. And I think that's an invitation for our time, really, to take it that large, not as something we should do in order to be good people, really just as if there's sincerity about awakening, how do I remove all the obstacles? How do I remove all the places where I say no and essentially reinforce this self-centered view or this conceit of being better than? And then I see for myself, it's no easy thing in a society where many of myself and others were so busy, but I think it's worthy of the investigation, just to take it on. In a way, essentially to say, what would it be like to befriend the world? Not to be so stingy in what we want to befriend. Let me see if I could get a quote. So the Buddha talked about good friends, and he said, "The helper, the friend who endures in good times and bad, the mentor and the compassionate friend. So the helper protects you when you are vulnerable, protects your wealth, is a refuge when you are afraid, and offers more than what is requested. The enduring and trustworthy friend tells you secrets, guards your secrets closely, does not abandon you in misfortune. The mentor restrains you from wrongdoing, guides you towards good actions, tells you what you ought to know, and shows you the path to peace. The compassionate friend does not rejoice in your misfortune, does not and delights in your good fortune, prevents others from speaking ill of you, and encourages others who praise your good qualities. Isn't that nice? May we all have those friends. And may we all be those friends. Right? I think you're starting to get the sense of like, it would feel good to be that kind of friend, to be able to offer that. Of course, we start with ourselves. It's not as though we beat up on ourselves and then try to offer all this good stuff to other people. There's really no separation. It's the attitude in the mind towards everything. So it includes us. And one of the things that I find most supportive, I mean, there's that, but I really touch into, oh, right, when that's happening, there's a profound sense of safety. And that releases fear and anxiety. And that is so helpful to just how we hold our bodies throughout the day. You know, when we're anxious, it takes energy, there's tightness, there's tension. When we're fearful, can't relax, looking over our shoulders, not sure, insecure. But to let that go. And then when you come to meditate, there's just not the same noise. I have an image, right, of like the old TV screens when they static. Right? You know, because it's hard when we sit down, we have these lives, and we sit down and we can just be like, all over the place. But when we're practicing 24/7, inclining 24/7 towards these beautiful states of mind, then when we sit down to meditate, we just sink in more quickly. And we incline more. I mean, there's still work to be done, right? The mind still will spin. But we bring those beautiful qualities into that meditation, and we meet whatever's happening in that meditation with a greater sense of ease and acceptance and curiosity and inquiry, all in the service of awakening. So in that way, I really believe as we extend care for others, we're giving ourselves a great gift of care. So I think that's all. Why don't we sit quietly for a few moments? So may we all enjoy the benefits of compassion and care, and may we all open our hearts to the world as it is, with all its beauty and chaos and joys and sorrows. May we respond in each and every moment with kindness, befriending ourselves and each other and the world. And may we all know the peace and freedom of a liberated mind.